Rav Moshe, what I'd like to discuss with you today, two topics, they're related to each other. One is Chovel L'Chaveiro, and that's a physical assault. And the other is Gneiva, when you sneak into someone's house and you steal something. And both of these laws, Chovel and Gonev and Gneiva, are codified here in Parashas Mishpatim. So this is really a shir for Parashas Mishpatim, and it perhaps is an overlap of Halach and Ashkafa. Let's begin with Chovel B'Chaveiro, which you'll see here on your pages. I have an extra copy here if anybody needs.
135. Yeah.
135. Now, here's the basic question we want to ask. Reuven physically assaults Shimon. And the Torah says, Ayin tachas ayin. If you translate that literally, it means an eye for an eye. So it sounds like the Torah is telling us that we should take out the eye of the chovel,
the offender,
and that's how he's going to be punished. And that's the literal translation of the pasuk. However, Chazal had a Kabbalah, they received the tradition that we don't take ayin tachas ayin literally, but rather we translate it as mamon. That means that the chovel is going to pay the nechbal the value of the chavola. And there's a whole perek in Shas called Perek HaChovel in Bava Kamma, which is dedicated to this question of, how do we know?
How do you estimate?
Right, that's number two. But first, how do you know that ayin tachas ayin is not to be taken literally? And number two, how do you evaluate the chavola? How much money should the chovel be paying for the nechbal? So that's the perek HaChovel. Again, if we wanted to dedicate ourselves to that perek, it would take us months to do it properly. Of course, in Daf Yomi, you could do it in a month, but if you want to do it properly, I always give you that little side swipe over there. You know, I have an agenda, you know. Okay. Nothing against Daf Yomi, it's a wonderful program, but a lot of people fool themselves. Okay, anyway, so we go on. Now, the son of the Chassam Sofer, his name is Rav Shimon Sofer. He was the Rav in Poland, in a major, major Jewish center called Krakow. My father-in-law was from Krakow. I mean, originally from Yaroslav, but he lived in Krakow. And he was once in a very, very sensitive situation. What happened was that there was a particular Jew who was we call it a mumar. You know, he was a person who rejected Judaism. And those are some of the biggest problems that we get in life. And at one point, this Rav Shimon Sofer, who unfortunately couldn't dedicate his life to learning Torah because of his particular position as the leader and the spokesman for the Jewish community, he spent a lot of time in various countries, especially in Austria, representing the Jewish people in front of the Austrian parliament. And in one particular case, there was a mumar, an apostate, I guess you might call him. And in order to undermine the Torah, he stood up in front of the parliament, this former Jew, if you want to say it. I mean, he was Jewish by birth. And he attacked Judaism by saying, how could it be that the Jewish people would subscribe to the primitive law of the Torah, that's what he said, Chas Shalom, of eye for an eye. He says that it's only in those dark places in the universe, you know, to certain backward cultures, where they apply that kind of punishment, that if somebody is guilty of a crime, they cut off his arm or something like that. So now, the Chassam Sofer immediately responded in this public forum that that's not true, that's a falsification of our Torah. Our Torah does not believe in taking off the eye of the chovel. It's mammon. That's how we understand the Torah. So of course this apostate was laughing at him, and he says, but it says in your holy scripture, it says eye for an eye. So in order to explain why that's impossible, meaning Rav Shimon Sofer had an insight into these three words, ayin tachas ayin, in order to analyze and prove that you cannot translate it the way you, this Mr. Mumar, was translating it, that we take out the eye of the chovel. He said the following. Here's his logic. Again, this is a little bit profound. We'll see if we can get it. If you look in the Torah, and this is true, lahavdil, for any legal text, you'll always find the following sequence. First, you'll be prohibited, you know, you're prescribed from doing something. You're enjoined from doing something. And then the legal text will tell us, well, if you violate that law, here's the punishment. He gives an example here. He says that after it says, lo sekalel, if it says, you're not allowed to curse someone, then it says, ish ki yakalel, and then we get to the punishment. Okay. And that's a case of a kalel of the imo, and there's a capital punishment, and then it says, vahumasa ish asher yakalel. Now, when we look at the pasuk, he said, of ayin tachas ayin, which, if you mean to interpret it, that we take out the eye of the chovel, and that's what ayin tachas ayin means, that because the eye of the nechbal was removed, therefore we're going to remove the eye of the chovel. Stop me if I'm going too fast. Are you with me so far? Okay, you have the chovel, the nechbal, right? So then he says, Rav Shimon Sofer claims the following, that we have to rewrite the text of the Torah. It shouldn't be written the way it is. It doesn't make sense, ayin tachas ayin. Why? It should have said the following. It should have said, tachas ayin, titein ayin. Which means, because he took out an eye, we'll take his eye. So again, the magic formula, if you translate and misunderstand this pasuk as taking out the eye of the chovel, the magic formula, the way that the Torah should have expressed itself and formulated this law is, tachas ayin, titein ayin. If I had a blackboard, I would write that on the blackboard. Okay? Tachas ayin, because he took out of his eye, titein ayin. You have to give your eye. So you violated the iser of tachas ayin, meaning you removed his eye, and therefore titein ayin will take out your eye. But instead, the Torah doesn't say tachas ayin, titein ayin. It says ayin tachas ayin. What does that mean? Does that mean we take out his eye for the other eye? Then you're telling me that the Torah is already telling me about the onish, the punishment, before you told me what he did. First tell me that he did some sort of criminal act, he violated, there was an offense, and then we take out his eye. But ayin tachas ayin simply means that we punish him by taking out his eye. That's the way you're interpreting it. That can't be, because that violates the basic principle. Give me just 2 minutes, Doc, if you don't mind, because again, it's very sensitive, and I don't have it yet, so you have to bear with me. Once I have it, you can hit me and throw your tomatoes at me. That's fine. So he's saying the following. If you're going to say that ayin tachas ayin is telling me the punishment, he says, well, first tell me the violation. And he says the following. The real true meaning of the pasuk is just the opposite. And when it says ayin, it means that he did the violation. He committed the crime. The word ayin means that he took out the eye of his friend. What then is his punishment? It's tachas ayin. The word tachas means in place of, or a substitute thereof. And what it means is that ayin, since he took out the eye of his friend, then our punishment for such a person who committed that offense is tachas ayin. What is tachas ayin? What does it mean that we substitute something for the eye? And the answer could only be mamon. So again, basically, let's just summarize, again, if we get to, it's very complex, but I'm trying to convince myself that I understand it. He's saying the following, that if the rule is that first you tell me what the offense is, and then you tell me the punishment, then it wouldn't make any sense that ayin tachas ayin is the punishment. Take out his eye in replacement for the eye that he took out from the nechbal. Because then there's no mention whatsoever of the violation. On the contrary, what it should have said was, tachas ayin titein ayin. Tachas ayin means because he took out his friend's eye and he did the offense, therefore titein ayin. Instead it says ayin tachas ayin. What is ayin tachas ayin? The first word in this three word phrase is the offense, which means ayin, he took out someone's eye. The second two words are the punishment, and the punishment is defined as tachas ayin. Tachas ayin means he must be punished with something that substitutes, that's what the word tachas means, for the ayin. And what's going to substitute for the ayin? Not the ayin itself, because that wouldn't be tachas ayin, that would be titen ayin, but rather mamon. He's going to have to pay in order to replace the eye. Okay, David, now you're on. Okay, now I have it, you know, because you can't ask me before I have it, because that's not good.
You said exactly what I was
going to
ask. As I
asked it. Oh, okay. So if you have any more questions, keep them in abeyance till we get the whole picture. In any event, there's an entire sugya in Baba Kama, in Perek HaChovel, as to this pasuk Ayin Tachas Ayin, and there the Shita Mekubetzes, which is one of the super commentaries on the Masechet Baba Kama, says the following: it cannot be that we would take out the eye of the Chovel in place of the eye of the Nechbal, because that would only make sense if both the Chovel and the Nechbal have the same eye, so to speak, meaning it's Shava B'Shava, they're equal. But he says there's so many different variables that go into the equation that it's impossible to say that the Torah meant to say we take out the eye for an eye. He gives one example. He says, for example, let's say that the Nechbal has two eyes, and both of them function properly. The Chovel, on the other hand, has only one eye. If you take out his eye, he becomes totally, totally blind. He says, L'chol Adam Yesh Ayin Acheres. He says, every person has a different eye. He says,
he has an additional eye.
In this case, he has an additional eye. Or, in the case of the Chovel, maybe only has one eye. So he says, you'll never get to the point of what he calls midah keneged midah. That's all of the punishments of the Torah should be based ethically on some sort of measure for measure. And therefore, since we cannot do that in the case of a Chovel and a Nechbal, it's absolutely imperative that we reinterpret the Torah, and instead of interpreting it as ayin tachas ayin, we're going to have to interpret it as mamon. How does this solve our problem? He says that mamon, paying damages, is objective. You know, that money is worth the same for everybody. You know, that's pretty true. How do we then evaluate the nechbal? And therefore the Torah, by saying mamon, is going to set up a system by which we can evaluate objectively how much is the eye of the nechbal worth. Right? Every system of law has to evaluate damages and figure out what damages are, how much you should pay for damages. In the case of Chavola, it becomes immensely complicated. How much is an eye worth? But in any event, the Torah, the Halacha, has set up a system by which we can have an evaluation of the worth of the eye. And Reuven the Nechbal has a different value for his eye than Shimon the Nechbal. But whatever evaluation we come to, that's how much the Chovel is going to pay. His payment is going to be appropriate measure for measure for the Nechbal. It's going to fit the Nechbal. It becomes subjective. If on the other hand you're going to say as an absolute rule we always take out the eye of the Chovel, then that doesn't fit into the Mida Keneged Mida, because in more cases than one, in fact I would say in most cases, it's not going to be Shava B'Shava. Now, if you take a look on page 136, he has a whole nother theory over here. And he wants to say that somehow the Nechbal should gain something from the punishment that's meted out to the Chovel. If, for example, you take the eye of the Chovel, then what does the Nechbal gain? He doesn't benefit, there's no compensation. Again, he may gain something psychological, you know, revenge or so and so forth. But on the other hand, from the perspective of the Nechbal, he wants to be paid or compensated for his loss. So the Gemara establishes that we evaluate five different categories of potential categories of loss. That's called Nezek Tzar, Ripui Sheves, and Boshes. And in each case, the Nechbal is going to receive some sort of compensation for his damage. Okay. So we can easily go through a number of these. Some of them are more complicated. In the case, for example, of Boshes, there's going to be a whole sugya. How do we evaluate the, you know, the humiliation caused to the Nechbal? In the case of Nezek, the Gemara says to evaluate the Nezek, that's the physical damage, we assess his value as a working person on the market and how much it's depreciated by as a result of the assault. And in the case of refuah, what's called ripui, we have to evaluate medical expenses. Now here the Gemara comes up with a very strange insight or a change in the law. What happens if the Nechbal calls up his personal physician and he gets a bill, you know, a what we call a hatzat mechir, you know, the physician tells him, this is what's, you know, you need a surgical procedure, this is what's going to cost you. And then the chovel comes into the courts and he says, I have a buddy, let's say in this particular circuit, who's a physician, he's a surgeon, and he's willing to do it for free. What would you say, Rabbo? So let's assume that the credentials of this buddy of the Chovel are equal or even surpass those of the local, you know, physician or the private physician of the Nechbal. What would you say? Why not do it for free? And the halacha says no. Why? So the Gemara Bava Kama on Daf Pei Hei applies the following principle. Asya b'magein magein shavya. Again, this is a big kasha on Kupat Cholim, but I'm not here as a spokesman for socialized medicine. Or, what are they called? Sin? I don't know, whatever it is in every country, it's different. What does this mean?
Magon.
Yeah. Rofei hamarape bechinam lo shaveh. A physician who will administer medical healing process without getting paid, that's not worth anything. Very strong statement.
You get what you pay for.
Right, you get what you pay for.
Nothing comes.
And basically he says what it means is that if a rofe is being paid for his work, then he's going to do a good job. He'll put in all his effort. But if he's doing it for free, you know, come see, come saw, you know, whatever he can do, he'll do. But he's not going to go to all effort. And therefore, it means that even though Yeshef Sharut Lachovel Rapeta Nichbal Al Yidei Chaviro Rofe Shemuchan Rapo Bechinam, even though the Chovel can guarantee the Nechbal that he will get all the medical service and attention that he can through his, meaning the Chovel's personal doctor, who's willing to work for free, that's not enough. Why? Because the ultimate goal here, and that's the whole purpose of the parasha of Nezek Tzar, Ripui Sheves, and Boshes, what we call Ayin Tachas Ayin Mamon, is to make sure and guarantee that the Nechbal will be reinstated to full health, and to guarantee that, it's critical that the Rofe be paid for his services. Okay. Now, in order to explain this idea that unless a person is paid for his services, he's not going to be, it's not a guarantee that he'll do a full good job. Right. He quotes the Maral Miprag. Now, in order to appreciate the insight of the Maral Miprag, we're going to posit a contradiction between a Gemara and a Shulchan Aruch, which is very odd, you know. And the Maral is going to reconcile this contradiction. The Gemara tells us in Masechta Nedarim, as far as teaching Torah is concerned, that a teacher of Torah is allowed to have how much of a salary? How much should you pay a teacher of a Torah?
Nothing.
Okay, you're right. You always guess the right answer. I was hoping you would say the wrong answer, but I see I can't pull that shtick over here. It doesn't work. Okay. And we learn this from Hashem teaching Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe is called upon to teach Torah just as Hashem taught him Torah. Ma'ani b'chinam afatah b'chinam. Just like Hashem did not take a salary for teaching Torah to Moshe, it was gratis. So to Moshe, when he teaches Torah, he too cannot take a salary. And from Moshe Rabbeinu teaching Torah without getting paid, that's called Bechinom, we derive a universal principle for every teacher of Torah that he should not be paid. That's what it says in the Gemara, and nobody denies it. However, the Shulchan Aruch, based on a different part of the same sugya, comes to the conclusion that we've got to find a way of paying the teachers. So the Gemara comes up with a concept called Schar Batola. You're familiar with that concept, meaning that this teacher could have taken on another job. You know, he has a PhD in engineering. He could have been paid a full salary as such, etc., etc. Or alternatively, in the case of young children, he should be paid for being Meshamer Es HaTinokos. Again, if this is an American phrase, I beg forgiveness. He's paid for babysitting.
Yeah,
okay, good. We probably got it from the Brits. Anyway, so he's a babysitter. And the truth is, Rabbi Moshe, I hate to be cynical about this, but if you pass a cheder where the children are very young, and some of these malamdim are absolutely amazing, how they keep the children preoccupied. I mean, you know, I go to visit my grandchildren's cheder when it's what they have a chumash party, when they give out the chumashim. And it's or after a child has an option, and it's very fascinating to see how the Rebbe keeps these children, these little teeny gorgeous little children, keeps them preoccupied. So we can pay him not for the teaching of Torah, but either for the effort that he places in keeping the children under supervision, or in replacement of some potential employment and financial wages that he could have accrued. So the Maharal wants to know the following question. Why is the Gemara standing on its head to find some sort of green light, you know, some sort of a heter and a permission, you know, work out this heter and this? It's all what we call in Yiddish, abissel gekvetscht. It's not so simple, you know. This, that, the other thing. Why are we looking for heterim? Now, you and I might have said, because otherwise the malamdim are going to go hungry. You know, they have to put food on the table. So Maharal is not excited about that, because he thinks that it's very critical from the Gemara's perspective that the parents pay for the tuition of the children. It's not enough if the community chest would pay the malamdim, meaning if our only motivation is to make sure that the malamdim have food to put on the table, we can find other methods. We don't have to bill the parents for tuition. He says, no. What Chazal want is, they want the children, the parents of the children, to be paying the salary. And why? Because he says that creates a personal relationship between the Malamed, the teacher, and the parents. And the Malamed, in order to satisfy the parents and make sure that he's doing a good job, he's going to put that extra effort in order to do the best possible job as a teacher and exploit all his energies, all his kishronos, his energies, in order to do a good job. And he says the same thing applies in the case of a doctor. You know, if the physician has a personal relationship, a financial relationship with his client, with his patient, the patient is paying him for his services, then within the context of that relationship, the rofe, insofar as he's being paid for his services, will extend himself a little bit further to do the best job that he possibly could. So that explains the din of rofe, which is ripui, one of the five categories of payment in the case of a chovel. Why is it that the Gemara rejects the claim of the chovel to say, well, I have a rofe who can do it for free? That's not going to guarantee the best possible physical, physician services for the sake of the nechbal. But now, Rabosai, I have to share with you a paragraph here on the bottom of page 136. You all have that?
Yes.
You don't have that.
Yes.
Okay, we had an extra one floating around, but yeah. Is anybody using this one?
This is 135.
Oh, this is 135. Okay, I don't know where it got lost here. I thought I made enough copies, but okay. Now, this paragraph, I don't know. I don't want to skip it, because I think he's building up to this, how should I say, pinnacle.
Climax.
This climax. But on the other hand, Harvey, I have to tell you the honest truth. I'm not sure I understand the punchline. Okay? So I'm telling you right up front you know, we spoke here a few weeks ago about limited liability. We're talking about a chovel who has full liability, but in this case, I'm taking upon myself only limited liability. Because I can follow the first half of the paragraph, and then when he gets to the pinnacle, he lost me. So Rabosai, we're all great scholars here in the room of Irtz Hashem, brilliant people, and I'm going to ask you to please try to tell me how to solve this riddle. I've been spending almost a half a year now on this sefer. It became my Bible for this. Every year I try to pick up a new sefer, and this is called Hei Menachamuni. And I love the sefer to pieces, but here, I don't know. I can't figure out what the man has in mind. So if you can help me with this, I'll be very thankful. So until now, I've been working for you. Now, quid pro quo, you're working for me, okay? I'm on the receiving end.
Do we get your part of your salary?
It's not worth that much, Michael, but... okay. So here's what's happening. He establishes a principle, a psychological principle, based on the Rambam's Moreh L'Nevuchim. You know, in the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, he wears one hat. And he doesn't get into any psychology or philosophy. He actually rejects all of that. And in his Moreh L'Nevuchim, which he wrote towards the end of his life, the Rambam wears a different hat. And there he's trying to figure out psychological rules. So what we're talking about now is a chote. And a chote has to do tshuva. And then the Rambam goes on to say that when a person suffers, let's say for example, Rachmana Litzlan, from ill health, it's a result of his chet. Says the Rambam, that you and I would think, again before we saw the Rambam, that in order for a person to restore his health, what he needs is refuah. He needs a physical process, you know, if the physician comes and so forth and so on. Says the Rambam, that's not enough. Why? Since the cause of illness is sin, therefore there's no solution or rectification of sin without tshuva. Mm-hmm. And therefore the Rambam establishes, again, I don't know how to justify the Rambam in reality, you know, because the reality looks a lot different than this, but the Rambam's principle is that every chole, in order to be misrape, to achieve health, must do tshuva. So you'll ask me, but this guy and that guy is not doing tshuva, how could it be? So that we'll get to on page 137, he's going to try to deal with that. But here on page 136, he's laying down the fundamental principle of the Rambam, and the assumption, the premise is that if you saw a chole who became healthy, you have the right to conclude that he must have done tshuva. In fact, Chazal say that when you come to visit a chole, you really should be in a standing position. Again, there are all sorts of permissibility, you know, permission for sitting, like if you're staying a long time at the bedside of a chole, but in theory, you know, in pure ideal world, you should be standing. Why should you be standing? Do you remember this, Harvey?
Yes.
Because who's there hovering over the chole?
The malach.
Right, okay, the malach. The Gemara says Shechina, but it's the same idea. And you should be standing in the presence of the Shechina. Now, what brings the Shechina down to the chole? So you can give two answers. One answer would be that God is meting out punishment to the sinner, so he must be around. But the Rambam's more profound understanding of the Rambam is that either Rambam, what's bringing the Shechina here is the fact that the chole, by virtue of his suffering, is doing tshuva. Now again, I don't know if the tshuva is on a conscious level, or if I could use a Freudian term, on a subconscious level, I don't know. But somehow the chole, wallowing in his suffering, is doing tshuva. Might be subconscious, I don't know. And as a result of this process of tshuva, the Shechina is there, etc., etc. Fine. That part of this paragraph, I can understand. And he quotes the Marsha, if you'll see about five lines into the paragraph, the Marsha says, "Ein lecha chole shelo mahar b'tshuva." There ain't no such thing as a chole who's not having hirhure tshuva. Again, the concept of hirhure tshuva might be something, as I called it,
nebulous.
Nebulous, it's subconscious. It's not that, you know, he's saying to himself, Ashamnu, Bagadu, and Vidu. But whatever it is, it's a hir tshuva. Mi yoseru mi pachol, says the Marsha. Some will do a more profound process of tshuva, some, but everyone's doing a minimum amount of tshuva. So now, If you're with me, we're ready for the punchline. Right? You called it the climax of this whole presentation. And here's where I can't figure out what the man says. And here's where I take a back seat, and you guys will have to teach it to me. He says the following. Vim came. Again, he's trying to explain the whole concept of a chovel. Chovel paying the nechbal. Ro'im anu, we see from this, shebechdei lehitrapei, in order to achieve healing. Okay. Now, Rabosa, in the case of a chovel and a nechbal, you have to ask yourself the question, who is trying to achieve healing? On a physiological level, who needs to be healed? The nechbal, correct? On a level of sin, it may be the chovel, but let's assume right now that he's referring to the nechbal. Okay, so he says the following. He says, "Kedei lehisrape yesh tzorech bashka'a mitzad hachole." You remember that we said earlier that the chole, in order to achieve restoration of health, has to pay the rofe. That's called a hashka'a. That means spending or investing. If he's going to get it for free, it's not going to cut the mustard. It's not going to achieve the goal. Correct? We also said that if I want my child to receive a proper education, I got to pay for it. So whenever you want to receive something, whether it's refuah in the case of a rofe, whether it's Torah in the case of a lamed, you have to exert yourself and you have to invest. That's called a hashkaah. In the case of a chole, since the Rambam's premise is that it's not just that he has a virus, but as they would say in Satmar, he has aviros, right? Right, that's how they say it in Satmar. It's not a virus, it's aviros. That's how they pronounce the word aviros. And it's sin. So if he's going to have to invest in the process of healing, then he's got to invest in tshuva. Okay, so far so good. And then he says, Kamochem, based on these principles, Efshar lahavin, now we can begin to understand, Sherak kasher hachovel mashkia mikiso. Okay, now who's making the investment here in the case of compensation? Is it the chovel or the nechbal?
It should be the chovel.
It should be the chovel, according to his presentation, but it's not the chovel. The one who's paying the bucks is the... It should be, what did you say, Harvey? Who should be paying? Who should be investing here? Well, what did you say to me? I'm sorry if you could repeat it. I jumped the gun because I thought you gave me what I thought would be the right answer here. Who should be, again, if we're saying that anyone who needs something, you know, let's say the chola needs refuah or the child needs education, the recipient is the one who has to make the investment. So in the case of the chovel and nechbal, who should be shelling out? The nechbal, though? That would be the logic. So he says, no. He says, hachovel mashkia mikiso.
He pays up.
He pays up, right? Because that's what compensation is all about. He's got to dig into his pockets. Avur harafua. And then he adds two words, umitztayer bedover. So for surely he's talking about the chovel here. There's no question. Virak oz, only then when the chovel makes this investment, and he's very sad about the minus in his bank account, he's paying major funds here, you know, all his assets are going down the tubes because he's paying out this lawsuit, you know, for Nezik Tzaripa Shevis and Boshas. He's very mitztayer. Rak oz, only then, Titochen refuas hanechbal. Only then, as a result of all the investment and the spending of money on the part of the chovel, only then can the nechbal achieve refuah. Can he be restored to health? Velo bechinam. I don't get it. I somehow lost it. Straighten me out. There's some jump over here because I don't get the logic. The logical structure that he establishes two principles. Principle number one is that if you want to get, you want to receive the best services, you got to pay for it. Principle number two is that a chole, in order to restore his health, he's got to pay for his refuah. And if it's seen from a spiritual level as a malady that's brought about by the divine intervention as a punishment, then he's got to do tshuva. Okay. Therefore, he says, we now understand why the chovel has to be paying money in order to guarantee that the Nechba will be restored to full health, because the Chovel is going to be mitztayer in the fact that he's digging into his pocket and he's spending money. Why is that? Again, if he wants to say, look, you know, the Nechbal is going to take this money and he's going to spend it, you know, for a physician, if that's what he's saying, okay, but that's not what he's saying. He's talking about the Tsar and the investment of the Chovel. You know, at one point it occurred to me that maybe he's talking about the process of tshuva that the Chovel has to undergo. And therefore the Chovel cannot achieve tshuva unless he suffers. But if that be the case, I would take the pasuk literally as ayin tachas ayin. I think it's a lot worse to have your eye taken out than to pay its value, I would think. I don't know. What's the connection here by paying the nechbal, you know?
Cases are not similar.
Yeah.
Somebody is ill.
Wait, Michael. Just so I put my head on straight. Are you going to give me pshat in what he's saying, or are you adding fuel to the flame?
No, I'm going to try.
Oh, excellent. Okay, so my head is on straight.
No, I'm just saying that I don't think the cases are similar. The case that he quotes in terms of the person being ill and having to do teshuva,
right,
there is only one person. It's right. The person who is ill, and you know, the process of getting better is to do teshuva.
Good.
Okay, that's only one person. Here, you've got two people.
Right.
Okay, so the cases are not similar.
But Michael, it sounds to me that you're adding fuel to the flame. What I'm looking for is some sort of explanation. You know,
it's the chovel that obviously has to pay out the money.
No, that I understand. But why does that clinch the refuah of the nechbal? His premise, his presentation is that in order for the Nechbal to achieve refuah, he's got to depend himself, totally dependent on the Chovel, who now by investing his money and suffering as a result, you know, in his bank account, that is going to clinch the refuah of the Nechbal. That's what I can't figure out. And I read this over about 5 times. Last night I asked my wife to read it because I thought maybe she'll understand it. And I just don't get it. And I don't have, you know, I'm not obligated to be, you know, the spokesman on behalf of the Tolna Rebbe, but I'm telling you, Rabosa, I've been learning now 6 months straight the Tolna Rebbe. I started at the end of Dvarim and already almost halfway through Shmos. That's probably about 6 months or more. And he's always on target. And here, he lost me in the shuffle here. Let me just try one more time, Rabosa. Maybe in the presence of a whole great tzibur, we can figure this out. That if the Nechbal wants to get refuah,
he's paying for it.
But he's not paying for it. I don't get it. He's not paying for it. The Chovel is paying for it. And on the contrary, he's trying to justify this whole concept of the Chovel paying for it. I don't know. I throw in the towel. I tried 5 times and I, you know, the trouble is he's not the most accessible person, the Tolna Rebbe, unless you're your mamash chassid, you know, and even then you have to wait. Alright, let's go on.
I need to go confused.
Yeah, sorry. In this case, Jerry. No, we got a lot of points that are very important. No. You know, I don't want you to throw in the, you know, throw away the baby with the dishwater, you know.
Is he still alive?
Sure.
Why don't you write him?
I tell you, I once tried to, on a different issue, I tried to get a hold of the man, and I didn't have the right connections. That's the honest truth. And the gabbai sort of roughed me up a little bit. I'm a sensitive guy, and he, you know, so I don't know. I'm sure there's a way of getting to him, but I just don't know how to do it.
Do you know somebody who knows him?
I know a few people. You know, I daven in Harnof in the Dutch shul. So there's one of the Dutchmen from Amsterdam who's one of the founding fathers there. His name is Mr. Moshe Moshkevitz. So I asked Moshe, this was years ago, when I had to ask a different question. Not this, I hadn't seen this. I said, how do I get to the Rebbe? So he told me X, Y, and Z. You know, he gave me the process, you know, steps 1, 2, and 3. Didn't help me. You know, and I said, wait a minute, Moshe Moshkevitz sent me here, you know, that doesn't do it, you know. If Moshe Moshkevitz was asking the question, then maybe we would. Anyway, so let's just see if we can go on, Rabosai. Okay.
Can I just say one thing?
Yes.
Why Why was the Nechbal chosen? I mean, something had to happen because of the Chovel had to do an action.
Yeah.
Which, that he could have done it on lots of different people. It could have been another Nechbal.
Right, that you're entering into the whole issue of Bechira Chofshis versus the suffering of an innocent victim. Meaning, on the one hand, the Torah has to guarantee Bechira Chofshis, which literally means that Reuven can kill Shimon. On the other hand, the Torah has to guarantee justice, an eye for measure for measure, midah keneged midah. How could Shimon, who's totally innocent, be killed by Reuven? So you're going to have to choose one of two. Again, it's obviously much deeper than this, but just to present the question. The question is that l'chora you're going to have to choose between one of two polar extremes, and you're going to, by definition, you're going to do harm to one of the most important principles that the Torah is founded on.
It's not true.
Let me just present the problem, and then you'll slug me up. So the problem is as follows: either you're going to tell me that Shimon is guilty, right, and then we have to ask the question: so if Shimon is guilty, why is Reuven held accountable if he's just a pawn, so to speak, a conduit in the hands of the Ribbono Shel Olam to mete out punishment to Shimon? And if on the other hand you're going to say, well, Shimon is guiltless, so how can Reuven take the life of Shimon? But the answer is Bechira Chofshis. We have to believe that anyone can kill anybody, which means I could even kill Chas Shalom, an innocent person. So if you're going to tell me that we guarantee within the framework of freedom of choice that a rotzeach, could kill an innocent victim, then how could Hashem stand idly by and let this innocent victim perish? If on the other hand, the innocent victim in the divine scheme of justice is guilty of some sin and deserves to die, so why is Reuven the rotzeach guilty for just being a pawn, a stick in the hands of the Ribbono Shel Olam?
It is the latter of the two cases. But for sure, Shimon was guilty and deserved to die. Question is, how was he going to die? And any number of people could have killed him, but it was Reuven that actually decided on his own free will he was going to kill him.
Right.
So he's guilty.
But you should know, Michael, that this is a tremendous machlokus in Chazal. There are two opinions. There's one opinion in Chazal that someone who's guiltless might be killed because we have to guarantee freedom of choice. And that's amazing. Again, you have to introduce Olam Haba and all the other concepts of Gilgul Neshamis and all the other answers that we have to give for the 6 million that perished in the Holocaust, or etc., etc., etc. But it doesn't mean that anyone who's killed was guilty as accused. According to that one sheet, again, there is a sheet that reflects it's a machlokas between, I think, the Arachayim HaKadosh and the Marsha, if I'm not mistaken. If you like, I'll get you the Mar Makomis for this. But according to one school of thought, we're not supposed to look at every single victim of murder as if he died because he was guilty of his sins. In other words, basically, let me put it to you this way. Are we willing to say, I'm going to say it to you in a very extreme way, that every single human being on the face of the earth deserves to die for his sins? No. Are we willing to say that every single human being on the face of the earth might be murdered in order to guarantee freedom of choice?
Yeah.
No. So then you're limiting freedom of choice. Do you understand what I'm saying? Either way, you're doing harm to a basic fundamental principle in Yiddishkeit. Unless you introduce metaphysics and Olam Haba and so forth and so on. Which again, that's going to be the classical answer. But in terms of Olam Hazeh, many are of the opinion that a guiltless person will die in order, so to speak, that phrase "in order" is a little bit out of order, but in order to guarantee the evildoer freedom of choice. He can kill any single human being walking the face of the earth. Let him be Malach Hashem Tzvakos. Let him be the holiest person that you can think of who never sinned. Okay, you might say, well, every person sins at some point. Ain't tzaddik ba'aretz. But I don't know if every person who sins deserves to die. But yet every person deserves the freedom to be able to kill everyone. This is a fascinating topic and it's very profound. And perhaps the only way out, like you say, is by introducing metaphysics. In other words, within the philosophical realm of the way we see reality, there's no solution to this problem. Okay. The Ramban, by the way, has a whole discussion about the Mitzrim, because already back in the Brisbane of Besarim, you remember that Hashem promised...
Why were they punished?
Correct. Why were the Mitzrim punished? In any event, this is a heavy issue. What I'd like to do is, again, if anyone has to go, please go, but spend a few minutes on the concept of Gneva. Why is it that the Torah is stricter with regard to Gneva than almost any other prohibition in the Torah? For example, there are many ways that you could cheat someone, chas v'shalom. You know, you could deny, refuse to pay him his wages. That's called oshek. Or, for example, you can put a gun to his head and steal his sheep or his goats. That's called gzela. And if a borrower refuses to pay back the lender, he violates an isur gzela as well. So there are many, many different violations in the Torah, but none of them have the punishment of kefel, except for a ganav. Not only that, a ganav, if he takes the cow and then he slaughters it, he might be chayv what's called dalet vehei. That's an amazing amount of money. If the cow is worth, 5,000 shekel, I don't know where the cow goes for these days, but multiply that by 4 or 5 times of its value, it could be an amazing amount of money. So the Talmud Rebbe in this Sefer, Hemi and Achamuni, again, if we had more time, I would go through with it with you. If you're not satisfied with, I don't blame you, with my, how shall I say, overview, then please photocopy the pages and go through it on your own. Because this is our last Chumash class for this week, I think. Although I do give a Chumash class at night, but tonight we're talking about Purim. What I wanted to suggest was the following explanation based on the Hema Yenachamuni. The Gemara tells us that there's a basic difference between a gazlan and a ganav. A gazlan is not afraid of anybody. He's not afraid of you, and he's not afraid of him, with a capital H. He's very consistent. He, in the light of day, the sunlight of day, he comes to you with a gun, and he says to you, your money or your life, right? That's a gazlan. A ganav, on the other hand, goes in stealthily, he sneaks into your house, and he takes whatever he takes. He's afraid of you. How do I know he's afraid of you? Because he's not willing to do it during the day. He does it at night or whenever he does it, and he's making sure that you're not around. Right? So if he knows how to pick a lock, he could even do it during the day. You know, he knows you're at work, so he picks the lock and he steals the money from your safe. That's called a ganav. So the Gemara says that the ganav is afraid of human beings, but he's not afraid of God. You know, the famous story, I heard it about the Chofetz Chaim, I heard it about Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, the story fits a lot of different giants, that the wagon driver said to the rabbi, he said to him, listen, do me a favor, you stand here and guard, and if anybody comes, let me know. And he starts stealing hay from, from something. So the rabbi says, Mizet, Mizet, we see you, they see you, they see you. So he comes back, and he says, who sees me? So finally, after this happens 3 or 4 times, he says, Mizet min ha-shamayim, right? So the ganav is not interested in we see from up on heaven. So that's called like a kfira, he's denying God. He's afraid of man, but he's not afraid of God. Whereas the gazlan, at least he's consistent, he's not afraid of anybody. He's not afraid of man, and he's not afraid of God. So the Rebbe quotes a number of questioners, those who question this concept, and they have trouble understanding. The gazlan is not afraid of God, so he's a kofar in any event. On top of that, he's not afraid of man. The ganav, at least he's afraid of man. He's not afraid of God. Why is the ganav worse off? Why is he culpable or liable for a more severe punishment than the gazlan? Yeah. If you were to tell me that the gazlan fears God, whereas the ganav doesn't, okay, nicha. But that's not the case. The gazlan has the same element of kfira against God as the ganav. The only difference is that the ganav is afraid of man, whereas the gazlan is not afraid of man. So in order to answer this question, he presents a number of different scenarios of Gneiva. You know, we think of Gneiva in the classical sense, where the Ganov stealthily, you know, burrows into the house of the Nignav, and he steals his money, you know, his kasefet, how you call it, his safe, or whatever he steals. But there are many, many other scenarios of Gneiva. For example, in a modern context, if you play around with the cashier, you know, with the cash registry, you can steal a lot of money from the balabais without anyone knowing about it. That too is Gneiva. Or for example, in today's modern society, if you get hold of a computer and you could break codes, and again, Rahman al-Islam, but there are people who do this and they embezzle gigantic sums of money. He's also a ganav. Why? Because he's afraid of man. He does it stealthily. He's working at his computer. Nobody knows what he's doing there. He's not afraid of God. And he's a ganav. And he goes on and on with many other situations. And he says the following. The problem with Gneiva is that because he does it stealthily, in hiding, not brazen and bold and open, he justifies it. There's something about Gneiva that the Yetzer Hara is particularly powerful. A Gazlan is a low person, morally, he's the lowest, though. He's aggressive, he's almost a murderer. He'll do whatever it takes to do to steal your money. And in a sense, he's sort of a pariah of society. There's something abnormal about him, you could say. You know, I'm not a psychiatrist, but you could certainly say that from a societal perspective, someone who does gzela, you know, and he comes to you face to face and he steals from you, that kind of aggressive gzela does not put you in a very high category. You know, you're not high caliber society. But Gneiva is something that even that is tempting if you have the talent to be a ganav. I'm not saying you should go to school to be a ganav, but you know, there are people who have these talents. I mean, I remember, I don't want to mention his name, but someone was here for Shabbos many years ago when we first started the LC, and what happened was that the only person who knew how to unlock the Aron Kodesh to get to the safe, it was on Shabbos morning, was not in shul. And we were desperate. You know, how do you get the Sefer Torah out? Nobody has the... So this person figured out the code. Wow. And he was able to break in. Now, I'm not saying he's a professional guy, but he has that talent. You know, there was a guy named Houdini, right? So yeah, there's certain people who are blessed or cursed with these talents. And almost anyone in almost any position, any situation in life could embezzle money stealthily and get away with it. If he does it cleverly. I mean, there's a guy in New York, I don't want to mention his name, you all know who I'm referring to, unfortunately he's a Jew, and he had these Ponzi schemes, and he was able to embezzle, I don't know how many, what were we talking about, Rabbi said, millions or billions of dollars, I don't remember what the numbers were, but phenomenal sums of money. And he did it with his brain. You know, nobody knew about it, it was stealthily done, and it was Gneiva. But imagine if you were in his shoes and you could make that kind of profit. You may be a respectable fellow, a member of society. I'm not coming to justify him, but I'm saying you can understand where the temptation is so powerful if you have those kinds of abilities and nobody has to know about it. And you could become a millionaire overnight if you implement those Gneiva talents that you have. Again, I would encourage you to go through the original because he embellishes it a lot more than what I made it out to be. But I just want to add one point. I read a book, and I can't find it, by Rav Solomon. I forgot his first name. Matisyo Solomon. Does that name ring a bell?
Yes.
Mashgiach of Lakewood Yeshiva.
Yes.
And he has a book that's dedicated to... He has many, many sfarim, but this one is dedicated to understanding the process of tshuva on Yom Kippur, on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And he has a whole chapter on one word in the Machzor, and that is gazalnu. Because in the vidui we say ashamnu, bagadnu, and then we say gazalnu. Now the underlining premise of his thesis is that Don't laugh at Oshamnu, at Bogabnu, and not even at Gazalnu, and say, why am I saying these words? Am I guilty of Gzela?
Yes.
Did I ever steal anything? And yes. The answer is yes. And it's a brilliant thesis. I can't wait till I get my hands on the sefer. I own the sefer, but like half of my sefer, I can't find them. I can give you a list of 10 different possibilities where they are. What? No, she doesn't know. It's just she's asking me to cut down on my sifriya. But I'm a crazy nut. I have to buy every sefer that comes out. You know what I'm saying? And expand my library. But I don't know where they are. It's either in Canada, or it's in Kew Garden Hills, or it's in Rabbi Meir, or it's in about 5 different places in Harnof. It might even be in Ramot because I use the Machsan for some of my sefer. I don't know. Anyway, I can't find half of my sefer. But that's my problem in life. You know, people ask, what's your vision of Olam Haba? My vision of Olam Haba is that I find everything that I lost during the course of my lifetime. That would be enough for me for Olam Haba.
Do you have a library?
A lot of pairs of eyeglasses.
Do you have a librarian that indexes all your sefer?
No, I don't have a secretary. I don't have a librarian. I don't have a bupkis. Anyway, anyway, if I ever get the sefer Abosa, if I find it amongst many of my misplaced sefer, I would love to read this with you together. Maybe we can photocopy. It's a chapter that was so meaningful for me because he shows you on a daily basis how you are challenged with temptations to steal people's money. Again, in order to do so, he reinterprets what gzela includes. You know, we've been talking mostly about gneva. He's talking about when he talks about gzela, he means gneva and gzela. You know, he's not going into this whole thing, but I just felt that, you know, if we're learning Parshas Mishpatim, well, with 42 mitzvahs, Beinon Lachavero. Gnevis Das, correct. And he goes on and on and on. He shows you how many different temptations we have of different forms of Gnevis. It's a beautiful piece. If I can only find the safe, I'd love to.
Gezel
Shena, excellent. Yeah, sometimes you disturb a person from sleeping. He has a whole shiloh about not answering phones. I mean, it's wild, you know, that.
Some sefer that talks about someone that's a ganav. The thing is that you were saying that a ganav is afraid of man to do anything. The thing is, it's said in this book that that you are allowed. If you see him, even if he's there, you don't see him, whatever, if you have a gun, it's perfectly legit to shoot him.
Ah. So that's called Baba Machteres. That's a parsha in the Torah, and yes. There it has to be clear that this robber is willing to kill you if you stand up against him. Right. So the assumption is that if he comes armed and he breaks into your house, then he's willing to kill you if you stand up against him, and you can habala hargacha hashkem, you can kill him first.
See,
it's a very fascinating sugi in Psachim and in Sanhedrin about a son who breaks into his own father's house, Rachmana Litzlan. I mean, it could bring tears to your eyes just to think about it. And the Gemara makes a chiluk between a son who breaks into his father's house and the opposite of a father breaks into his son's house.
Oh, man.
You know, and the Gemara says that in the case of a father who breaks into his son's house, he would never kill his own son, you know, so the son is not allowed to kill. Okay, I'm not going into it. That's a whole... Since you mentioned Bob Machteres, so I'll just conclude with his, he ends here this whole presentation about Gneva. We did the one about Chavola. That's on these pages. The one about Gneva, he comes to the conclusion that... The Gemara tells about Rabbi Yochanan and Zakkai, you'll all remember this, in Brachas Daf Chav Ches, that on his deathbed he gave a blessing to his students. And you remember what he said to them?
Hope that your fear of God will be not less than your fear of mankind.
Yimore shamayim kimore bosa v'dor. In other words, there are so many things that we can get away with by fooling other people. And the temptation sometimes is great. He says, halavai, that we should have the same kind of fear that we have for another human being catching us in the crime. Yes. You know, like, for example, the kind of, he's afraid that he might get caught red-handed. Oh, if he only had the fear of God, like the fear of man, that would prevent him from sin. And he goes on to tell you that the gazlanim and the poshim, they belong to shulei achevra. They're on the outskirts, the periphery of society. Charigim, Me'izim la'avor l'chok v'shak nefesh. They're alimut, alimim, and they're aggressive, and so forth and so on. And those guys certainly have to be locked up in jail. They are an absolute threat to society. But he says the ganov, here it's a much more subtle kind of avera. And it could be tempting even to someone who's mina minyan, so to speak. He's a member of society. Ubiglal shamasim ha'elu em kol kach shchichim. Since it's very commonplace for different forms of gneva, where you know you do things in hiding, to be committed, he says, nasim b'chol kach harbe. There are so many different situations, and people come up with all sorts of justifications. Nobody will see me, and they convince themselves, and he's not going to lose that much anyway. You know, everybody comes up with his justifications. He said, nimtza. As a result, he says, ramat ha-sikun, the level of danger for gneva, is gvoha ma'od likashel b'kach. We're not talking about some sort of crazy, you know, murderous or violent criminal. And therefore, maisim b'chol yom mochichim zot shechashuv la-torah, it's so important, lahachmir al-haganim. I'm just reading the last line in this very long article. Lahachmir al-haganim b'chumros rabos. These are strictures that we don't find with regard to any other violation. Kidei lahadgish et anyan. Shall I enroll them out? We can only get the fear of God. You know, we're afraid of man, but we don't want to get caught. But we're not afraid of God. So we can overcome all those, you know, powerful inclinations that bring us down that path. Miyiten, he says, halavayshin is care, lachush, that we should all feel in our lives the ayin roeh, the seeing eye of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, b'chol ma'aseinu, yi'olenu, there be upon us morah shamayim, kemorah basar v'dam. Amen. That's how he ends the presentation. Again, if anyone has the opportunity to photocopy these pages and go through them, I highly recommend them. I started with Kabbalah, but I got stuck at a certain my voice satum over there.
You're right. Yeah,